a row. 8 standard weeks after she arrived on Renaissance, Saul and Saray waved goodbye to Rachel and Melio at the Da Vinci Farcaster multiport, and then Farcast home to Barnard's world. "I don't think she should have left the hospital," muttered Saray as they took the evening shuttle to Crawford. The continent was a patchwork of harvest-ready right angles below them. "Mother," said Saul, touching her knee, "the doctors would have kept her there forever. But they're doing it for her own curiosity now. They've done everything they can to help her. Nothing. She has a life to live." "But why go away with him?" said Saray. "She barely knows him." Saul sighed and leaned back against the cushions of his seat. "In 2 weeks, she won't remember him at all," he said. "At least in the way they share now. Look at it from her position, Mother. Fighting every day to reorient herself in a world gone mad. She's 25 years old and in love. Let her be happy." Saray turned her face to the window, and together, not speaking, they watched the red sun hang like a tethered balloon on the edge of evening. Saul was well into the second semester when Rachel called. It was a one-way message via Farcaster cable from Freeholm, and her image hung in the center of the old hollow pit like a familiar ghost. "Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Sorry I haven't written or called the past few weeks. I guess you know that I've left the university. And Melio. It was dumb to try to take new graduate-level stuff. I'd just forget Tuesday or whatever was discussed Monday. Even with disks and comlog prompts, it was a losing battle. I may enroll in the undergraduate program again. I remember all of it. Just kidding. It was just too hard. With Melio, too. Or so my notes tell me. It wasn't his fault, I'm sure of that. He was gentle and patient and loving to the end. It's just that, well, you can't start from scratch on a relationship every day. Our apartment was filled with photos of us, notes I wrote to myself about us, hollows of us on Hyperion, but, you know, in the morning, he would be an absolute stranger. By afternoon, I began to believe what we'd had, even if I couldn't remember. By evening, I'd be crying in his arms. Then, sooner or later, I'd go to sleep. It's better this way. Rachel's image paused, turned as if she was going to break contact, and then steadied. She smiled at them. "So, anyway, I've left school for a while. The Freeholm Med Center wants me full-time, but they'd have to get in line. I got an offer from the Tau Ceti Research Institute that's hard to turn down. They offer a, I think they call it a research honorarium. That's bigger than what we paid for 4 years at Knightenhelzer and all of the Reichs combined. I turned them down. I'm still going in as an outpatient, but the RNA transplant series just leaves me with bruises and a depressed feeling. Of course, I could just be depressed because every morning I can't remember where the bruises came from. Anyway, I'll be staying with Tanya for a while, and then maybe, I thought maybe I'd come home for a while. 2nd month's my birthday. I'll be 22 again. Weird, huh? At any rate, it's a lot easier being around people I know, and I met Tanya just after I transferred here when I was 22. I think you understand. So, is my old room still there, Mom? Or have you turned it into a mahjong parlor like you always threatened? So write, or give me a call. Next time I'll shell out the money for two-way so we can really talk. I guess I thought..." Rachel waved. "Gotta go. See you later, alligators. I love you both." Saul flew to Basard City the week before Rachel's birthday to pick her up at the world's only public Farcaster Terminix. He saw her first, standing with her luggage near the floral clock. She looked young, but not noticeably younger than when they had waved goodbye on Renaissance Vector. No, Saul realized, there was something less confident about her posture. He shook his head to rid himself of such thoughts, called to her, and ran to hug her. The look of shock on her face when he released her was so profound that he could not ignore it. "What is it, sweetie? What's wrong?" It was one of the few times he had ever seen his daughter totally at a loss for words. I forgot, she stammered. She shook her head in a familiar way and managed to laugh and cry at the same instant. You look a little different, is all, Dad. I remember leaving here like it was literally yesterday, when I saw your hair. Rachel covered her mouth. Saul ran his hand across his scalp. Ah, yes, he said, suddenly close to laughing and crying himself. With your school and travels, it's been more than 11 years. I'm old and bald. He opened his arms again. Welcome back, little one. Rachel moved into the protective circle of his embrace. For several months, things went well. Rachel felt more secure with familiar things around, and for Saray, the heartbreak of their daughter's illness was temporarily offset by the pleasure of having her home again. Rachel rose early every morning and viewed her private orientation show, which, Saul knew, contained images of him and Saray 12 years older than she remembered. He tried to imagine what it was like for Rachel. She awoke in her own bed, memory fresh, 22 years old, home on vacation before going off-world to graduate school, only to find her parents suddenly aged, 100 small changes in the house and town, the news different, years of history having passed her by. Saul could not imagine it. Their first mistake was in acceding to Rachel's wishes in inviting her old friends to her 22nd birthday party. The same crew who had celebrated the first time, irrepressible Nikki, Don Stewart and his friend Howard, Kathy Obeg and Marta Tin, her best friend Lina McKeiler, all of them then just out of college, shucking off cocoons of childhood for new lives. Rachel had seen them all since her return, but she had slept and forgotten. And Saul and Saray this one time did not remember that she had forgotten. Nikki was 34 standard, with 2 children of her own, still energetic, still irrepressible, but ancient by Rachel's standards. Don and Howard talked about their investments, their children's sports accomplishments, and their upcoming vacations. Kathy was confused, speaking only twice to Rachel, and then as if she was speaking to an impostor. Marta was openly jealous of Rachel's youth. Lina, who had become an ardent Zen Gnostic in the years between, cried and left early. When they had gone, Rachel sat in the post-party ruin of the living room and stared at the half-eaten cake. She did not cry. Before going upstairs, she hugged her mother and whispered to her father, "Dad, please don't let me do anything like that again." Then she went upstairs to sleep. It was that spring when Saul again had the dream. He was lost in a great, dark place, lighted only by 2 red orbs. It was not absurd when the flat voice said, "Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." And Saul had screamed into the darkness, "You already have her, you son of a bitch. What do I have to do to get her back? Tell me. Tell me, goddamn you." And Saul Weintraub woke, sweating, with tears in his eyes and anger in his heart. In the other room, he could feel his daughter sleeping, while the great worm devoured her. In the months which followed, Saul became obsessive about obtaining information on Hyperion, the Time Tombs, and the Shrike. As a trained researcher, he was astounded that there were so little hard data on so provocative a topic. There was the Church of the Shrike, of course. There were no temples on Barnard's world, but many in the web. But he soon found that seeking hard information in Shrike cult literature was like trying to map the geography of Sarnath by visiting a Buddhist monastery. Time was mentioned in Shrike church dogma, but only in the sense that the Shrike was supposed to be the angel of retribution from beyond time, and that true time had ended for the human race when old Earth died, and that the 4 centuries since had been false time. Saul found their tracts, the usual combination of double talk and naval lint gathering common to most religions. Still, he planned to visit a Shrike church temple as soon as he had explored more serious avenues of research. Melio Arendez launched another Hyperion expedition, also sponsored by Rijks University, this one with the stated goal of isolating and understanding the time-tide phenomenon which had inflicted the Merlin sickness on Rachel. A major development was the Hegemony Protectorate's decision to send along on that expedition a Farcaster transmitter for installation at the Hegemony Consulate in Keats. Even so, it would be more than 3 years' web time before the expedition arrived on Hyperion. Saul's first instinct was to go with Arendez and his team. Certainly any holodrama would have the primary characters returning to the scene of the action. But Saul overrode the instinctive urge within minutes. He was a historian and philosopher. Any contribution he might make to the expedition's success would be minute at best. Rachel still retained the interest and skills of a well-trained undergraduate archaeologist-to-be, but those skills dwindled a bit each day, and Saul could see no benefit to her returning to the site of the accident. Each day would be a shock to her, awakening on a strange world, on a mission which would require skills unknown to her. Saray would not allow such a thing. Saul set aside the book he was working on, an analysis of Kierkegaard's theories of ethics as compromise morality as applied to the legal machinery of the hegemony, and concentrated on collecting arcane data on time, on Hyperion, and on the story of Abraham. Months spent carrying on business as usual and collecting information did little to satisfy his need for action. Occasionally, he vented his frustration on the medical and scientific specialists who came to examine Rachel like streams of pilgrims to a holy shrine. "How the hell can this be happening?" he screamed at one little specialist who had made the mistake of being both smug and condescending to the patient's father. The doctor had a head so hairless his face looked like lines painted on a billiard ball. "She's begun growing smaller," Saul shouted, literally buttonholing the retreating expert. "Not so one can see, but bone mass is decreasing. How can she even begin to become a child again? What the hell does that do to the law of conservation of mass?" The expert had moved his mouth but had been too rattled to speak. His bearded colleague answered for him. "M. Weintraub," he said, "Sir, you have to understand that your daughter is currently inhabiting, think of it as a localized region of reversed entropy." Saul wheeled on the other man. "Are you saying that she is merely stuck in a bubble of backwardness?" No, said the colleague, massaging his chin nervously. "Perhaps a better analogy is that, biologically, at least, the life metabolism mechanism has been reversed,
Nonsense, snapped Saul. "She doesn't excrete for nutrition or regurgitate her food? And what about all the neurological activity? Reverse the electrochemical impulses and you get nonsense. Her brain works, gentlemen. It's her memory that is disappearing. Why, gentlemen, why?" The specialist finally found his voice. We don't know why, M. Weintraub. Mathematically, your daughter's body resembles a time-reversed equation, or perhaps an object which has passed through a rapidly spinning black hole. We don't know how this has happened, or why the physically impossible is occurring in this instance, M. Weintraub. We just don't know enough.
Saul shook each man's hand. Fine. That's all I wanted to know, gentlemen. Have a good trip back.
On Rachel's 21st birthday, she came to Saul's door an hour after they had all turned in.
Daddy?
What is it, kiddo?
Saul pulled on his robe and joined her in the doorway.
Can't sleep?
I haven't slept for 2 days, she whispered. Been taking stay-awakes so I can get through all of the briefing stuff I left in the wanna-know file.
Saul nodded.
Daddy, would you come downstairs and have a drink with me? I've got some things I want to talk about.
Saul got his glasses from the nightstand and joined her downstairs. It proved to be the first and only time that Saul would get drunk with his daughter. It was not a boisterous drunk. For a while they chatted, then began telling jokes and making puns, until each was giggling too hard to continue. Rachel started to tell another story, sipped her drink just at the funniest part, and almost snorted whiskey out her nose, she was laughing so hard. Each of them thought it was the funniest thing that had ever happened.
I'll get another bottle, said Saul when the tears had ceased. Dean Moore gave me some scotch last Christmas, I think.
When he returned, walking carefully, Rachel had sat up on the couch and brushed her hair back with her fingers. He poured her a small amount, and the two drank in silence for a while.
Daddy?
Yes?
I went through the whole thing. Saw myself, listened to myself, saw the hollows of Lina and the others all middle-aged.
Hardly middle-aged, said Saul. Lina will be 35 next month.
Well, old, you know what I mean. Anyway, I read the medical briefs, saw the photos from Hyperion, and you know what?
What?
I don't believe any of it, Dad.
Saul put down his drink and looked at his daughter. Her face was fuller than before, less sophisticated, and even more beautiful.
I mean, I do believe it, she said with a small scared laugh. It's not like you and Mom would put on such a cruel joke. Plus there's your age and the news and all. I know it's real, but I don't believe it. Do you know what I mean, Dad?
Yes, said Saul.
I mean, I woke up this morning and I thought, great, tomorrow's the paleontology exam and I've hardly studied. I was looking forward to showing Roger Sherman a thing or two. He thinks he's so smart.
Saul took a drink. Roger died 3 years ago in a plane crash south of Bassard, he said. He would not have spoken without the whiskey in him, but he had to find out if there was a Rachel hiding within the Rachel.
I know, said Rachel and pulled her knees up to her chin. I accessed everybody I knew. Graham's dead. Professor Eichhardt isn't teaching anymore. Nikki married some salesman. A lot happens in 4 years.
More than 11 years, said Saul. The trip to and from Hyperion left you 6 years behind us stay-at-homes.
But that's normal, cried Rachel. People travel outside the web all the time. They cope.
Saul nodded. But this is different, kiddo.
Rachel managed a smile and drained the last of her whiskey.
Boy, what an understatement.
She set the glass down with a sharp final sound. Look, here's what I've decided. I've spent 2.5 days going through all the stuff I prepared to let me know what's happened, what's going on, and it just doesn't help.
Saul sat perfectly still, not even daring to breathe.
I mean, said Rachel, knowing that I'm getting younger every day, losing the memory of people I haven't even met yet, I mean, what happens next? I just keep getting younger and smaller and less capable until I just disappear someday? Jesus, Dad.
Rachel wrapped her arms more tightly around her knees. It's sort of funny in a weird way, isn't it?
No, Saul said quietly. No, I'm sure it's not, said Rachel.
Her eyes, always large and dark, were moist. It must be the worst nightmare in the world for you and Mom. Every day, you have to watch me come down the stairs, confused, waking up with yesterday's memories, but hearing my own voice tell me that yesterday was years ago, that I had a love affair with some guy named Emilio.
Emilio, whispered Saul.
Whatever. It just doesn't help, Dad. By the time I can even begin to absorb it, I'm so worn out that I have to sleep. Then, well, you know what happens then.
What?
Began Saul, and had to clear his throat.
What do you want us to do, little one?
Rachel looked him in the eye and smiled. It was the same smile she had gifted him with since her fifth week of life.
Don't tell me, Dad, she said firmly. Don't let me tell me. It just hurts. I mean, I didn't live those times.
She paused and touched her forehead. You know what I mean, Dad. The Rachel who went to another planet and fell in love and got hurt, that was a different Rachel. I shouldn't have to suffer her pain. She was crying now. Do you understand? Do you?
Yes, said Saul.
He opened his arms and felt her warmth and tears against his chest.
Yes, I understand.
Fatline messages from Hyperion came frequently the next year, but they were all negative. The nature and source of the anti-entropic fields had not been found. No unusual time-tide activity had been measured around the Sphinx. Experiments with laboratory animals in and around the tidal regions had resulted in sudden death for some animals, but the Merlin sickness had not been replicated. Emilio ended every message with, "My love to Rachel." Saul and Sarai used money loaned from Rijks University to receive limited Poulsen treatments in Basard City. They were already too old for the process to extend their lives for another century, but it restored the look of a couple approaching 50 standard rather than 70. They studied old family photos and found that it was not too difficult to dress the way they had a decade and a half before. 16-year-old Rachel tripped down the stairs with her comlog tuned to the college radio station. "Can I have rice cereal?"
"Don't you have it every morning?" smiled Saray.
"Yes," grinned Rachel. "I just thought we might be out or something. I heard the phone. Was that Nikki?"
"No," said Saul.
"Damn," said Rachel and glanced at them. Sorry, but she promised she'd call as soon as the standardized scores came in. 3 weeks since tutorials. You'd think I'd have heard something.
"Don't worry," said Saray.
She brought the coffee pot to the table, started to pour Rachel a cup, poured it for herself.
"Don't worry, honey. I promise you that your scores will be good enough to get you into any school you want."
"Mom," sighed Rachel, "you don't know. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there."
She frowned.
"Have you seen my math Ansible? My room was all messed around. I couldn't find anything."
Saul cleared his throat.
"No classes today, kiddo."
Rachel stared.
"No classes? On a Tuesday? 6 weeks from graduation? What's up?"
"You've been sick," Saray said firmly. "You can stay home one day. Just today."
Rachel's frown deepened.
"Sick? I don't feel sick. Just sort of weird. Like things aren't right, somehow. Like, why is the couch moved around in the media room? And where's Chips? I called and called, but he didn't come.
Saul touched his daughter's wrist. You've been sick for a while, he said. The doctor said you might wake up with a few gaps. Let's talk while we walk over to the campus. Want to?
Rachel brightened.
Skip classes and go to the college? Sure.
She faked a look of consternation.
As long as we don't run into Roger Sherman. He's taking freshman calculus up there, and he's such a pain.
We won't see Roger, said Saul. Ready to go?
Almost.
Rachel leaned over and gave her mother a huge hug.
Later, alligator.
Wild crocodile, said Saray.
Okay, grinned Rachel, her long hair bouncing. I'm ready.
The constant trips to Bassard City had required the purchase of an EMV, and on a cool day in autumn, Saul took the slowest route, far below the traffic lanes, enjoying the sight and smell of the harvested fields below. More than a few men and women working in the fields waved to him. Bassard had grown impressively since Saul's childhood, but the synagogue was still there on the edge of one of the oldest neighborhoods in the city. The temple was old. Saul felt old. Even the yarmulke he put on as he entered seemed ancient, worn thin by decades of use. But the rabbi was young. Saul realized that the man was at least 40. His hair was thinning on either side of the dark skullcap. But to Saul's eyes, he was little more than a boy. Saul was relieved when the younger man suggested that they finish their conversation in the park across the street. They sat on a park bench. Saul was surprised to find himself still carrying the yarmulke, passing the cloth from hand to hand. The day smelled of burning leaves and the previous night's rain.
I don't quite understand, M. Weintraub, said the rabbi. Is it the dream you're disturbed about, or the fact that your daughter has become ill since you began the dream?
Saul raised his head to feel the sunlight on his face.
Neither, exactly, he said. I just can't help but feel that the two are connected somehow.
The rabbi ran a finger over his lower lip.
How old is your daughter?
13, said Saul, after an imperceptible pause.
And is the illness serious, life-threatening?
Not life-threatening, said Saul, not yet. The rabbi folded his arms across an ample belly.
You don't believe... May I call you Saul?
Of course.
Saul, you don't believe that by having this dream, that somehow you've caused your little girl's illness, do you?
No, said Saul, and sat a moment, wondering deep within if he was telling the truth.
No, Rabbi, I don't think... Call me Mort, Saul.
All right, Mort. I didn't come because I believe that I, or the dream, am causing Rachel's illness. But I believe my subconscious might be trying to tell me something.
Mort rocked back and forth slightly.
Perhaps a neurospecialist or psychologist could help you more there, Saul. I'm not sure what I'm
interested in the story of Abraham, interrupted Saul. I mean, I've had some experience with different ethical systems, but it's hard for me to understand one which began with the order to a father to slay his son.
No, 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 cried the rabbi, waving oddly childlike fingers in front of him.
When the time came, God stayed Abraham's hand. He would not have allowed a human sacrifice in his name. It was the obedience to the will of the Lord that...
Yes, said Saul, obedience. But it says,
Then Abraham put forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. God must have looked into his soul and seen that Abraham was ready to slay Isaac. A mere show of obedience without inner commitment would not have appeased the God of Genesis. What would have happened if Abraham had loved his son more than he loved God?
Mort drummed his fingers on his knee a moment and then reached out to grasp Saul's upper arm. Saul, I can see you're upset about your daughter's illness. Don't get it mixed up
with a document written 8,000 years ago. Tell me more about your little girl. I mean, children don't die of diseases anymore, not on the web.
Saul rose, smiled, and stepped back to free his arm. I'd like to talk more, Mort. I want to. But I have to get back. I have a class this evening.
Will you come to temple this Sabbath?
Asked the rabbi, extending stubby fingers for a final human contact.
Saul dropped the yarmulke into the younger man's hands.
Perhaps one of these days, Mort. One of these days, I will.
Later the same autumn, Saul looked out the window of his study to see the dark figure of a man standing under the bare elm in front of the house. The media, thought Saul, his heart sinking. For a decade, he had been dreading the day the secret got out, knowing it would mean the end of their simple life in Crawford. He walked out into the evening chill.
Melio? He said when he saw the tall man's face.
The archaeologist stood with his hands in the pockets of his long blue coat. Despite the 10 standard years since their last contact, Arundas had aged but little. Saul guessed that he was still in his late 20s, but the younger man's heavily tanned face was lined with worry.
Saul, he said, and extended his hand, almost shyly.
Saul shook his hand warmly. I didn't know you were back. Come into the house.
No.
The archaeologist took a half step back. I've been out here for an hour, Saul. I didn't have the courage to come to the door.
Saul started to speak, but then merely nodded. He put his hands in his own pockets against the chill.
The first stars were becoming visible above the dark gables of the house.
Rachel's not home right now, he said at last. She went to the library. She thinks she has a history paper due.
Melio took a ragged breath and nodded in return.
Saul, he said, his voice thick, you and Saray need to understand that we did everything we could. The team was on Hyperion for almost 3 standard years. We would have stayed if the university hadn't cut our funds. There was nothing—
We know, said Saul. We appreciated the fat line messages.
I spent months alone in the Sphinx myself, said Melio. According to the instruments, it was just an inert pile of stones, but sometimes I thought I felt something.
He shook his head again.
I failed her, Saul.
No, said Saul, and gripped the younger man's shoulder through the wool coat. But I have a question. We've been in touch with our senators, even talked to the Science Council directors, but no one can explain to me why the hegemony hasn't spent more time and money investigating the phenomena on Hyperion. It seems to me that they should have invested that world into the web long ago, if only for its scientific potential. How can they ignore an enigma like the tombs?
I know what you mean, Saul. Even the early cutoff of our funds was suspicious. It's as if the hegemony had a policy to keep Hyperion at arm's length.
Do you think, began Saul, but at that moment Rachel approached them in the autumn twilight. Her hands were thrust deep in her red jacket, her hair was cut short in the decades-old style of adolescence everywhere, and her full cheeks were flushed with the cold. Rachel was teetering on the brink of childhood and a young adulthood. Her long legs in jeans, sports shoes, and bulky jacket might have been the silhouette of a boy. She grinned at them.
Hi, Dad.
Stepping closer in the dim light, she nodded at Melio shyly.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt your conversation.
Saul took a breath. That's all right, kiddo. Rachel, this is Dr. Arundez from Rijks University on Freeholm. Dr. Arundez, my daughter Rachel.
Pleased to meet you, said Rachel, beaming in earnest now. Wow, Rijks, I've read their catalogs. I'd love to go there someday.
Melio nodded rigidly. Saul could see the stiffness in his shoulders and torso.
Do you? Began Melio. That is, what would you like to study there?
Saul thought the pain in the man's voice must be audible to Rachel, but she only shrugged and laughed.
Oh, geez, everything! Old Mr. Eichhardt, He's the paleontology archaeology toot in the advanced class I take up at the Ed Center. He says they have a great classics and ancient artifacts department.
They do, managed Melio.
Rachel glanced shyly from her father to the stranger, apparently sensing the tension there but not knowing the source.
Well, I'm just interrupting your conversation more here. I've got to get in and get to bed. I guess I've had this strange virus. Sort of like meningitis, Mom says. Only it must make me sort of goofy. Anyway, nice to meet you, Dr. Arendes. I hope I'll see you at Reich someday.
I hope that too, said Melio, staring at her so intensely in the gloom that Saul had the feeling he was trying to memorize everything about the instant.
Okay, well,
said Rachel, and stepped back, her rubber-soled shoes squeaking on the sidewalk. Good night, then. See you in the morning, Dad.
Good night, Rachel.
She paused at the doorway. The gas light on the lawn made her look much younger than 13.
Later, alligators.
Wild crocodile, said Saul, and heard Melio whisper it in unison. They stood a while in silence, feeling the night settle on the small town. A boy on a bicycle rode by, leaves crackling under his wheels, spokes gleaming in the pools of light under the old street lamps. Come in the house, Saul said to the silent man. Saray will be very pleased to see you. Rachel will be asleep.
Not now, said Melio.
He was a shadow there, his hands still in his pockets. I need to...
It was a mistake, Saul.
He started to turn away, looked back. I'll phone when I get to Freeholm, he said. We'll get another expedition put together.
Saul nodded. 3 years transit, he thought. If they left tonight, she would be not quite 10 before they arrive.
Good, he said. Melio paused, raised a hand in farewell, and walked away along the curb, ignoring the leaves that crunched underfoot. Saul never saw him in person again. The largest church of the Shrike in the web was on Lussis, and Saul Farcast there a few weeks before Rachel's 10th birthday. The building itself was not much larger than an old earth cathedral, but it seemed gigantic, with its effect of flying buttresses in search of a church, twisted upper stories, and support walls of stained glass. Saul's mood was low, and the brutal Lussian gravity did nothing to lighten it. Despite his appointment with the bishop, Saul had to wait more than 5 hours before he was allowed into the inner sanctum. He spent most of the time staring at the slowly rotating 20-meter steel and polychrome sculpture which might have been of the legendary Shrike, and might have been an abstract homage to every edged weapon ever invented. What interested Saul the most were the two red orbs floating within the nightmare space which might have been a skull.
M. Weintraub?
Your Excellency, said Saul. He noticed that the acolytes, exorcists, lectors, and ostiaries who had kept him company during the long wait had prostrated themselves on the dark tiles at the high priest's entry. Saul managed a formal bow.
Please, please do come in, M. Weintraub, said the priest.
He indicated the doorway to the Shrike sanctuary with a sweep of his robed arm. Saul passed through, found himself in a dark and echoing place not too dissimilar from the setting of his recurring dream, and took a seat where the bishop indicated. As the cleric moved to his own place at what looked like a small throne behind an intricately carved but thoroughly modern desk, Saul noticed that the high priest was a native Lussian, gone to fat and heavy in the jowls, but formidable in the way all Lussis residents seemed to be. His robe was striking in its redness, a bright arterial red, flowing more like a contained liquid than like silk or velvet, trimmed in onyx ermine. The bishop wore a large ring on each finger, and they alternated red and black, producing a disturbing effect in Saul. "Your Excellency," began Saul, "I apologize in advance for any breach in church protocol which I have committed, or may commit.
I confess I know little about the Church of the Shrike, but what I do know has brought me here. Please forgive me if I inadvertently display my ignorance by my clumsy use of titles or terms. The bishop wiggled his fingers at Saul. Red and black stones flashed in the weak light. Titles are unimportant, M. Weintraub. Addressing us as Your Excellency is quite acceptable for a non-believer. We must advise you, however, that the formal name of our modest group is the Church of the Final Atonement, and the entity whom the world so blithely calls the Shrike, we refer to, if we take his name at all, as the Lord of Pain, or more commonly, the Avatar. Please proceed with the important query you said you had for us. Saul bowed slightly. Your Excellency, I am a teacher. Excuse us for interrupting, M. Weintraub, but you are much more than a teacher. You are a scholar. We are very familiar with your writings on moral hermeneutics. The reasoning therein is flawed, but quite challenging. We use it regularly in our courses in doctrinal apologetics. Please proceed. Saul blinked. His work was almost unknown outside the most rarefied academic circles, and this recognition had thrown him. In the 5 seconds it took him to recover, Saul found it preferable to believe that the Shrike bishop wanted to know with whom he spoke and had an excellent staff. Your Excellency, my background is immaterial. I asked to see you because my child, my daughter, has taken ill as a possible result of research she was carrying out in an area which is of some importance to your church. I speak, of course, of the so-called time tombs on the world of Hyperion. The bishop nodded slowly. Saul wondered if he knew about Rachel. You are aware, M. Weintraub, that the area you referred to, what we call the Covenant Arcs, have recently been declared off-limits to so-called researchers by the Home Rule Council of Hyperion. Yes, Your Excellency, I have heard that. I understand that your church was instrumental in that legislation being passed. The bishop showed no response to this. Far off in the incense-layered gloom, small chimes sounded. At any rate, Your Excellency, I hoped that some aspect of your church's doctrine might shed light on my daughter's illness. The bishop inclined his head forward so that the single shaft of light which illuminated him gleamed on his forehead and cast his eyes into shadow. Do you wish to receive religious instruction in the mysteries of the church, M. Weintraub? Saul touched his beard with a finger. No, Your Excellency, unless in doing so I might improve the well-being of my daughter. And does your daughter wish to be initiated into the Church of the Final Atonement? Saul hesitated a beat. Again, Your Excellency, she wishes to be well. If joining the church would heal or help her, it would be a very serious consideration. The bishop sat back in a rustle of robes. Redness seemed to flow from him into the gloom. You speak of physical well-being, M. Weintraub. Our church is the final arbiter of spiritual salvation. Are you aware that the former invariably flows from the latter? I am aware that this is an old and widely respected proposition, said Saul. The total well-being of our daughter is the concern of my wife and myself. The bishop rested his massive head on his fist. What is the nature of your daughter's illness, M. Weintraub? It is a time-related illness, Your Excellency. The bishop sat forward, suddenly tense. And at which of the holy sites did you say your daughter contracted this malady, M. Weintraub? The artifact called the Sphinx, Your Excellency. The bishop stood so quickly that papers on his desktop were knocked to the floor. Even without the robes, the man would have massed twice Saul's weight. In the fluttering red robes, stretched to his full height, the Shrike priest now towered over Saul like crimson death incarnate. You can go, bellowed the big man. Your daughter is the most blessed
and cursed of individuals. There is nothing that you or the church, or any agent in this life, can do for her." Saul stood, or rather sat his ground. "Your Excellency, if there is any possibility—"
"No!"
cried the bishop, red in the face now, a consummately consistent apparition. He tapped at his desk. Exorcists and lectors appeared in the doorway, their black robes with red trim an ominous echo of the bishop. The all-black ostiaries blended with the shadows. "The audience is at an end," said the bishop, with less volume but infinite finality. "Your daughter has been chosen by the Avatar to atone in a way which all sinners and non-believers must someday suffer. Someday, very soon."
"Your Excellency, if I can have just 5 minutes more of your time."
The bishop snapped his fingers, and the exorcists came forward to escort Saul out. The men were Lussian. One of them could have handled 5 scholars Saul's size.
"Your Excellency!"
cried Saul, after he had shrugged off the first man's hands. The 3 other exorcists came to assist with the equally brawny lectors hovering nearby. The bishop had turned his back and seemed to be staring into the darkness. The outer sanctuary echoed to grunts and the scraping of Saul's heels, and to at least 1 loud gasp as Saul's foot made contact with the least priestly parts of the lead exorcist. The outcome of the debate was not affected. Saul landed in the street. The last ostiary to turn away tossed Saul's battered hat to him. 10 more days on Lussus achieved nothing but more gravity fatigue for Saul. The temple bureaucracy would not answer his calls, the courts could offer him no wedge, the exorcists waited just within the doors of the vestibule. Saul farcast to New Earth and Renaissance Vector, to Fuji and TC Squared, to Deneb Dry and Deneb Fear, but everywhere the Shrike temples were closed to him. Exhausted, frustrated, out of money, Saul cast home to Barnard's world, got the EMV out of the long-term lot, and arrived home an hour before Rachel's birthday.
"Did you bring me anything, Daddy?"
asked the excited 10-year-old. Saray had told her that day that Saul had been gone. Saul brought out the wrapped package. It was the collected Anne of Green Gables series. It was not what he had wanted to bring her.
"Can I open it?"
"Later, little one, with the other things."
"Oh, please, Dad, just one thing now, before Nikki and the other kids get here."
Saul caught Saray's eye. She shook her head. Rachel remembered inviting Nikki and Lina and her other friends to the party only days before. Saray had not yet come up with an excuse.
"All right, Rachel," he said. "Just this one before the party."
While Rachel ripped into the small package, Saul saw the giant package in the living room, secured with red ribbon. The new bike, of course. Rachel had asked for the new bike for a year before her 10th birthday. Saul tiredly wondered if she would be surprised tomorrow to find the new bike here the day before her 10th birthday. Or perhaps they would get rid of the bike that night, while Rachel slept. Saul collapsed onto the couch. The red ribbon reminded him of the bishop's robes. Saray had never had an easy time of surrendering the past. Every time she cleaned and folded and put away a set of Rachel's outgrown baby clothes, she had shed secret tears that Saul somehow knew about. Saray had treasured every stage of Rachel's childhood, enjoying the day-to-day normalcy of things. A normalcy which she quietly accepted as the best of life. She had always felt that the essence of human experience lay not primarily in the peak experiences, the wedding days and triumphs which stood out in the memory like dates circled in red on old calendars, but rather in the unself-conscious flow of little things. The weekend afternoon, with each member of the family engaged in his or her own pursuit, their crossings and connections casual, dialogues imminently forgettable, but the sum of such hours creating a synergy which was important and eternal. Saul found Saray in the attic, weeping softly as she went through boxes. These were not the gentle tears once shed for the ending of small things. Saray Weintraub was angry. "What are you doing, Mother?" "Rachel needs clothes. Everything is too big. What fit on an 8-year-old won't fit on a 7-year-old. I have some more of her things here somewhere."
"Leave it," said Saul. "We'll buy something new."
Saray shook her head.
"And have her wonder every day where all of her favorite clothes have gone? No, I've saved some things. They're here somewhere.
Do it later."
"Damn it, there is no later,"
shouted Saray, and then turned away from Saul and raised her hands to her face.
"I'm sorry."
Saul put his arms around her. Despite the limited Poulsen treatments, her bare arms were much thinner than he remembered. Knots and cords under rough skin. He hugged her tightly.
"I'm sorry," she repeated, sobbing openly now. "It's just not fair."
"No," agreed Saul, "it's not fair." The sunlight coming through the dusty attic panes had a sad cathedral quality to it. Saul had always loved the smell of an attic, the hot and stale promise of a place so underused and filled with future treasures. Today, it was ruined. He crouched next to a box. "Come, dear," he said. "We'll look together." Rachel continued to be happy, involved with life, only slightly confused by the incongruities which faced her each morning when she awoke. As she grew younger, it became easier to explain away the changes that appeared to have occurred overnight. The old elm out front, gone. The new apartment building on the corner where M. Nesbitt used to live in a colonial-era home. The absence of her friends. And Saul began to see, as never before, the flexibility of children. He now imagined Rachel living on the breaking crest of a wave of time, not seeing the murky depths of the sea beyond, keeping her balance with her small store of memories and a total commitment to the 12 to 15 hours of now allowed her each day. Neither Saul nor Saray wanted their daughter isolated from other children, and it was difficult to find ways to make contact. Rachel was delighted to play with the new girl or new boy in the neighborhood. Children of other instructors, the grandchildren of friends, for a while with Nikki's daughter. But the other children had to grow accustomed to Rachel greeting them anew each day, remembering nothing of their common past, and only a few had the sensitivity to continue such a charade for the sake of a playmate. The story of Rachel's unique illness was no secret in Crawford, of course. The fact of it had spread through the college the first year of Rachel's return, and the entire town knew soon after. Crawford reacted in the fashion of small towns immemorial. Some tongues wagged constantly. Some people could not keep the pity and pleasure at someone else's misfortune out of their voices and gazes. But mostly, the community folded its protective wings around the Weintraub family, like an awkward mother bird shielding its young. Still, they were allowed to live their lives, and even when Saul had to cut back classes and then take an early retirement because of trips seeking medical treatment for Rachel, the real reason was mentioned by no one. But it could not last, of course. And on the spring day when Saul stepped onto the porch and saw his weeping 7-year-old daughter coming back from the park, surrounded and followed by a pack of newsteeps, their camera implants gleaming and comlogs extended, he knew that a phase of their life was over forever. Saul jumped from the porch and ran to Rachel's side. "M. Weintraub, is it true that your daughter contracted a terminal time illness? What's going to happen in 7 years? Will it just disappear?" M. Weintraub, M. Weintraub. Rachel says that she thinks Rabin Dowell is Senate CEO, and this is the year AD 2711. Has she lost those 34 years completely, or is this a delusion caused by the Merlin sickness? Rachel, do you remember being a grown woman? What's it feel like to be a kid again? M. Weintraub, M. Weintraub, just one still image, please. How about you get a picture of Rachel when she was older, and you and the kids stand looking at it? M. Weintraub, is it true that this is the curse of the time tombs? Did Rachel see the Shrike monster? Hey, Weintraub, Sol, hey, Solly, what are you and the little woman going to do when the kid's gone?
There was a news teep blocking Sol's way to the front door. The man leaned forward. The stereo lenses of his eyes elongated as they zoomed in for a close-up of Rachel.
Sol grabbed the man's long hair, which was conveniently tied in a queue, and flung him aside. The pack brayed and bellowed outside the house for 7 weeks.
Sol realized what he had known and forgotten about very small communities. They were frequently annoying, always parochial, sometimes prying on a one-to-one level, but never had they subscribed to the vicious legacy of the so-called public's right to know. The web did. Rather than have his family become permanent prisoners to the besieging reporters, Sol went on the offensive. He arranged interviews on the most pervasive Farcaster cable news programs, participated in all-thing discussions, and personally attended the Concourse Medical Research Conclave. In 10 standard months, he asked for help for his daughter on 80 worlds. Offers poured in from 10,000 sources, but the bulk of the communications were from faith healers, project promoters, institutes and freelance researchers offering their services in exchange for the publicity, Shrike cultists and other religious zealots pointing out that Rachel deserved the punishment, requests from various advertising agencies for product endorsements, offers from media agents to handle Rachel for such endorsements, offers of sympathy from common people, frequently enclosing credit chips, expressions of disbelief from scientists, offers from Holly producers and book publishers for exclusive rights to Rachel's life, and a barrage of real estate offers. Rijks University paid for a team of evaluators to sort the offers and see if anything might benefit Rachel. Most of the communications were discarded. A few medical or research offers were seriously considered. In the end, none seemed to offer any avenue of research or experimental therapy which Rijks had not already tried. One fatline flimsy came to Saul's attention. It was from the chairman of Kibbutz Kfar Shalom on Hebron, and read simply, "If it becomes too much, come." It soon became too much. After the first few months of publicity, the siege seemed to lift, but this was only the prelude to the second act. Fax-simmed tabloids referred to Saul as the Wandering Jew, the desperate father wandering afar in search of a cure for his child's bizarre illness, an ironic title, given Saul's lifelong dislike of travel. Saray inevitably was the grieving mother, Rachel was the doomed child, or in one inspired headline, virgin victim of the time tomb's curse. None of the family could go outside without finding a newsteep or imager hiding behind a tree. Crawford discovered that there was money to be found in the Weintraub's misfortune. At first, the town held the line, but when entrepreneurs from Bassard City moved in with gift shops, T-shirt concessions, tours, and data chip booths for the tourists who were coming in larger and larger numbers, the local business people first dithered, then wavered, then decided unanimously that if there was commerce to be carried on, the profits should not go to outsiders. After 438 standard years of comparative solitude, the town of Crawford received a Farcaster Terminex. No longer did visitors have to suffer the 20-minute flight from Bassard City. The crowds grew. On the day they moved, it rained heavily, and the streets were empty. Rachel did not cry, but her eyes were very wide all day, and she spoke in subdued tones. It was 10 days before her 6th birthday.
"But, Daddy, why do we have to move?"
"We just do, honey."
"But why?"
"It's something we have to do, little one. You'll like Hebron. There are lots of parks there."
"But how come you never said we were going to move?"
"We did, sweetie. You must have forgotten."
"But what about Graham and Grams and Uncle Richard and Aunt Tetha and Uncle Saul and everybody?"
"They can come visit us any time."
"But what about Nikki and Lina and my friends?"
Saul said nothing but carried the last of the luggage to the EMV. The house was sold and empty. Furniture had been sold or sent ahead to Hebron. For a week, there had been a steady stream of family and old friends, college associates, and even some of the Reich's med team who had worked with Rachel for 18 years. But now, the street was empty. Rain streaked the perspex canopy of the old EMV and ran in complex rivulets. The three of them sat in the vehicle for a moment, staring at the house. The interior smelled of wet wool and wet hair. Rachel clutched the teddy bear Saray had resurrected from the attic 6 months earlier. She said,
"It's not fair."
"No," agreed Saul. "It's not fair." Hebron was a desert world. 4 centuries of terraforming had made the atmosphere breathable, and a few million acres of land arable. The creatures which had lived there before were small and tough and infinitely wary, and so were the creatures imported from old Earth, including the humankind. "Ah," gasped Saul the day they arrived in the sun-baked village of Dan above the sun-baked kibbutz of Kfar Shalom. "What masochists we Jews are! 20,000 surveyed worlds fit our kind when the Hegira began, and those schmucks came here." But it was not masochism which brought either the first colonists or Saul and his family. Hebron was mostly desert, but the fertile areas were almost frighteningly fertile. Sinai University was respected throughout the web, and its med center brought in wealthy patients and a healthy income for the cooperative. Hebron had a single Farcaster Terminex in New Jerusalem and allowed portals nowhere else. Belonging to neither the hegemony nor protectorate, Hebron taxed travelers heavily for Farcaster privilege and allowed no tourists outside New Jerusalem. For a Jew seeking privacy, it was perhaps the safest place in 300 worlds trod by man. The kibbutz was more a cooperative by tradition than in operation. The Weintraubs were welcomed to their home, a modest place offering sun-dried adobe, curves instead of right angles, and bare wood floors, but also offering a view from the hill which showed an infinite expanse of desert beyond the orange and olive groves. The sun seemed to dry up everything, thought Saul, even worries and bad dreams. The light was a physical thing. In the evening their house glowed pink for an hour after the sun had set. Each morning Saul sat by his daughter's bed until she awoke. The first minutes of her confusion were always painful to him, but he made sure that he was the first thing Rachel saw each day. He held her while she asked her questions.
"Where are we, Daddy?"
"In a wonderful place, little one. I'll tell you all about it over breakfast."
"How did we get here?"
"By casting and flying and walking a bit," he would say. "It's not so far away, but far enough to make it an adventure."
"But my bed's here. My stuffed animals. Why don't I remember coming?"
And Saul would hold her gently by the shoulders and look into her brown eyes and say, "You had an accident, Rachel. Remember in The Homesick Toad, where Terence hits his head and forgets where he lives for a few days? It was sort of like that."
"Am I better?"
"Yes," Saul would say. "You're all better now." and the house would fill with the smell of breakfast, and they would go out to the terrace where Saray waited. Rachel had more playmates than ever. The kibbutz cooperative had a school where she was always the welcome visitor, greeted anew each day. In the long afternoons, the children played in the orchards and explored along the cliffs. Avner, Robert, and Ephraim, the council elders, urged Saul to work on his book. Hebron prided itself on the number of scholars, artists, musicians, philosophers, writers, and composers it sheltered as citizens and long-term residents. The house, they pointed out, was a gift of the state. Saul's pension, though small by Webb standards, was more than adequate for their modest needs in Kfar Shalom. To Saul's surprise, however, he found that he enjoyed physical labor. Whether working in the orchards or clearing stones in the unclaimed fields, or repairing a wall above the city, Saul found that his mind and spirit were freer than they had been in many years. He discovered that he could wrestle with Kierkegaard while he waited for mortar to dry, and find new insights in Kant and Van Dur while carefully checking the apples for worms. At the age of 73 standard, Saul earned his first calluses. In the evenings, he would play with Rachel and then take a walk in the foothills with Saray as Judy or one of the other neighbor girls watched their sleeping child. One weekend, they went away to New Jerusalem, just Saul and Saray. The first time they had been alone together for that long since Rachel returned to live with them 17 standard years before. But everything was not idyllic. Too frequent were the nights when Saul awoke alone and walked barefoot down the hall to see Saray watching over Rachel in her sleep. And often, at the end of a long day, bathing Rachel in the old ceramic tub or tucking her in as the walls glowed pinkly, the child would say, "I like it here, Daddy, but can we go home tomorrow?" And Saul would nod. And after the goodnight story and the lullaby and the goodnight kiss, sure that she was asleep, he would begin to tiptoe out of the room only to hear the muffled, "Later, alligator," from the blanketed form on the bed, to which he had to reply, "Wild crocodile." And lying in bed himself, next to the softly breathing and possibly sleeping length of the woman he loved, Saul would watch the strips of pale light from one or both of Hebron's small moons move across the rough walls, and he would talk to God. Saul had been talking to God for some months before he realized what he was doing. The idea amused him. The dialogues were in no way prayers, but took the form of angry monologues, which, just short of the point where they became diatribes, became vigorous arguments with himself. Only not just with himself. Saul realized one day that the topics of the heated debates were so profound, the stakes to be settled so serious, the ground covered so broad, that the only person he could possibly be berating for such shortcomings was God himself. Since the concept of a personal God, lying awake at night, worrying about human beings, intervening in the lives of individuals, always had been totally absurd to Saul. The thought of such dialogues made him doubt his sanity. But the dialogues continued. Saul wanted to know how any ethical system, much less a religion so indomitable that it had survived every evil mankind could throw at it, could flow from a command from God for a man to slaughter his son. It did not matter to Saul that the command had been rescinded at the last moment. It did not matter that the command was a test of obedience. In fact, the idea that it was the